Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. The United States now has around 280,000 COVID deaths out of around 1.5 million worldwide. So we have 4% of the world's population, 18% of the deaths. Obviously, there are things we're not doing right. And with cases, hospitalizations, and deaths spiking nationwide now, more and more drastic shutdown measures are coming to more and more places as maybe our only recourse until the vaccines really get out there. Here is Berkeley, California public health officer Dr. Lisa Hernandez over the weekend.
Until we get through this wave, you should not meet in person with anyone you do not live with, even in a small group, and even outdoors with precautions. If you have a social bubble, it is now popped.
So America, are we ready to pop our social bubbles for a while to prevent the worst of the worst? Do restaurants and other small businesses really have to close, or can they stay open with social distancing? And are we ready to equitably distribute and to be willing to take the COVID vaccines? Will Joe Biden's nominees for Health and Human Services Secretary and CDC Director make a difference? If you haven't heard, he's reportedly nominating California Attorney General and former Congressman Javier Becerra for HHS and Rochelle Walensky, Chief of the Infectious Disease Department at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston and a Harvard Med School professor, to revive the Centers for Disease Control, which has been so marginalized by President Trump. And then there's Rudy Giuliani and apparently three state legislatures he's exposed before being diagnosed with COVID yesterday. Lawmakers in Michigan, Georgia, and Arizona. Lots of Rudy hugs and loud droplet spreading, rooting, talking. Hardly ever a Rudy mask. With me now, Dr. Wafa El-Sadr, epidemiology and global health professor at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. She is also director of their center known as ICAP, leading the design, implementation, scale-up, and evaluation of large-scale HIV and other public health programs in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. Dr. El-Sadr has also been a MacArthur Genius Grant winner for some of that global health work. It's great to have you again. Welcome back to WNYC, Doctor.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.
So many places we could start. But how about that clip from Dr. Hernandez from Berkeley Public Health? The hardest hit parts of California are going for serious stay-at-home orders again as of today. Is it necessary, in your opinion?
I do believe it's necessary. As has been mentioned before, and as we're all aware of, the situation is quite alarming in the United States and almost every part of this country in terms of the large numbers of cases and hospitalizations and deaths. This poses a huge individual health threat, but also as well threat to the health system itself. And there's some areas where there's the risk of overwhelming hospitals and intensive care units and so on. So it's time to act. And I think that is the reason why in Berkeley they're moving ahead with these kinds of interventions now, to say we have to do what we know works. And that means that we have to limit the exposure to other people as much as we can until we can get over this crisis. I think the time is now to do whatever can be done to limit contact between people so that we can stop transmission of this virus.
To limit contact between people. It sounds so draconian when we put it that way. I know we were there in the New York area and California too, in a more preventive way. Mm-hmm. In the spring, New York, in reaction to how widely the virus spread there. And on the other side of the country from Berkeley, Staten Island, maybe known as a pro-police, so-called law and order borough of New York City. Being pro-police and law and order was a big reason they just replaced Democrat Max Rose with Republican Nicole Malliotakis for Congress. But the big story out of Staten Island this weekend was the anti-police rhetoric and alleged anti-police violence by a bar owner who was repeatedly breaking COVID safety laws and then allegedly drove his car into a sheriff's deputy trying to serve him a summons, breaking multiple bones on the sheriff's body, we are told. Now, that's one allegedly violent criminal miscreant, but there are many otherwise law-abiding small business owners who think they can stay open, have social distancing and mask policies, and not spread the virus, but still be able to make a living. My question for you, Dr. El-Sadr, is does the data suggest yes or no? Is there good data on this? Can businesses open with real social distancing policies, limiting capacity in their stores or restaurants, with mask policies, and not spread the virus? Or do we know that's how the virus is spreading to some degree?
Well, I think it depends. I always think it depends on the type of business. I think it's particularly alarming if you, for bars and restaurants to, for example, have indoor dining or indoor, congregation in bars, for example, because those are settings where people are close together and also where people remove their masks. So that's particularly dangerous kinds of environments. I think it's very different from a situation where people are going for necessities, like, for example, going to get food shopping and so on, where I believe that with the limitations on density and keeping the numbers of people who can enter into a supermarket to the appropriate level, as well as with the physical distancing and the masking, I think those are situations where that can be done more safely. So I think it's the manner, it's not just the any business, it's the type of business, how essential is that business, and also the fact that there are some situations where just by the nature of the activities that are going on, that people do remove their masks for prolonged periods of time, and that's what we know allows for transmission of this virus.
You know, Dr. El-Sadr, I want to try a few different call-ins while you're on with us. First one, let's try something, listeners. If you've gotten COVID in the last month, where do you think you got it? 646-435-7280. We know cases are on the rise in the last month. If you got COVID in the last month, where do you think you got it? 646-435-7280. I don't want to hear from you if you got it in March or April or May, or if you think you got it last December and it wasn't diagnosed. I want to hear from you if you think you got COVID in the last month, where do you think you got it? 646-435-7280. We'll call this an informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific piece of anecdotal epidemiology. But maybe we will at least learn some questions to ask, as anecdotal evidence can sometimes provide in public health. So if you've gotten COVID in the last month, where do you think you got it? In a bar or restaurant? In a store? In a train or a plane or a bus? At a small gathering with your social bubble that the public health officer of Berkeley wants you to pop? Did you get it at Thanksgiving? It's 11 days now, so maybe you did, and maybe you know you did. Did you get it at Thanksgiving? Did you get it at the Michigan State Legislature's informal hearing when you got your picture snapped with Rudy Giuliani? If you got COVID in the last month, where do you think you got it? 646-435-7280. 646-435-7280 for public health professor Dr. Wafa El-Sadr from the Columbian Mailman School. 646-435-7280. And look at that. Boy, the phones are lighting up, which means, unfortunately, Dr. El-Sadr, even here in the New York area, there are a lot of people who got COVID in the last month. I guess we know that from the positivity rates and the hospital occupancy, right?
Yep, absolutely. I think now we're up to about 2,000 new cases every day in New York City. You can contrast this with August and September, and where we had sometimes only 300 new cases per day. So this is almost tenfold increase. In the daily numbers of new cases in the city.
For you who have worked so much on Africa and Asia with respect to HIV in the past, why do you think the United States and Western Europe have been hit so much harder than Africa in particular? It's not in the news very much, and I feel like our listeners know more about the difference between here and Asia, I think, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, but that in Asia there were more strict lockdown policies at first, at the beginning. They had more experience there with SARS and other past infectious diseases that are similar to COVID. So they did the real isolation and contact tracing there in ways we didn't in the United States. But what about Africa? How do you explain Africa with its relatively low rates compared to Europe and Asia? I mean, Europe and the United States.
Yeah, I think this has been an enigma, and there are several possibilities or several hypotheses that we believe may play a role in why African countries have not been as hit as hard as the United States or European countries. Firstly, is the pandemic came to them later than it did to Europe and the United States. So I think in many ways that this allowed the leadership and the public health leadership as well as the political leadership in those countries to be poised to be better prepared than we were. So I think just the timing in and of itself may have helped these African countries. I think another factor is they actually, many of these countries moved very quickly to put in place quite strong, what we call mitigation control measures. So they went very quickly to, for example, putting in place the limitations in terms of travel, domestic travel, international travel. They rapidly also closed schools and universities. They also issued the stay-at-home directives as well. So there was a rapid movement to putting in some of these strict measures. I think for the United States, for some European countries, we did it more incrementally. So that's the second factor. And third factor is the population is very different. The population in many African countries is much younger than the average population age in several European countries, as well as in the United States. And we know that, of course, COVID-19, just getting infected at an older age is associated with much more likelihood of getting sick and, unfortunately, also the likelihood of dying from COVID-19. Keep in mind that we now know that 40% of the death from COVID-19 in this country occurred, unfortunately, amongst nursing home residents. So I think because of these kind of the actions that these leaders did and did very promptly, I think because of some of the public health measures that were put in place, and lastly, probably as well because of just the population distribution and the younger population in African countries, that may also have helped as well. I think we should also be cautious because many of the countries in Africa still don't have sufficient supply of testing, for example. So it's possible that we're missing a lot of cases of COVID-19, particularly cases with no symptoms, where you actually need a test to detect such an infection. Yes, so those are just some of the reasons that that we hypothesize for the African situation.
Very interesting. All right, you ready to do some thoroughly unscientific epidemiology with our callers?
Yes,
and
please.
Where they think they got COVID in the last month. We'll start with Juan in Queens. Juan, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, how are you? How's it going?
Good. How about you?
So my wife, it's my wife actually, she caught it the day, well, we found out she caught it the day before Thanksgiving. And what was interesting was my son's girlfriend, who's 24, she's always in our house. And they study together because they're both taking college classes. She wasn't feeling well. She had a fever, and she wanted to get tested. So my wife took her. She was adamant about not getting tested. And I said, listen, if you're going to be with her, if she's positive, you're positive. And it turned out they both were positive. And interestingly, though, no one else in the household caught it. I got tested twice since then, and I've been negative. So it's a little confusing for us.
That's so interesting. Juan, and that by itself, Dr. Elsader, is an interesting story. A, not everybody who's exposed in the same household gets it. I've heard that before from people. And B, here's a story about your bubbles, right? And we don't know what kinds of lifestyle. Their son and his girlfriend, who were in their 20s, were living, and then the parents are exposed.
Yes, and I think obviously another important thing to keep in mind is if you have any symptoms, I think people should not come together with anyone else. So having any symptoms should prompt the person to please stay at home and go get tested. I think that's the most, that's very important lesson from the what you just the scenario that you just described. I think also just to build on the issue of transmission within households or people who live together, and this is maybe a more scientific survey, but the city itself did a survey where they asked contacts and where they thought they got those who got infected, where they thought they got the infection from, and the largest proportion was from the household, from people that they were living together with.
So somebody had to bring it into the household from doing something outside.
Right. And then it's transmitted within the household thereafter, people that live together.
Let's go through a few more real quick. I'm going to ask you all to keep this fairly short so we just get some basic facts about what you think is the chain of transmission on the table here. So let's go next to Zainab on Staten Island. Zainab, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, a long-time listener. So I actually developed COVID on the 13th of November, and I tend to suspect, and I got tested on the 14th, and so it came back positive a couple of days later. So I tend to suspect that, you know, I got it at work. Even though I'm an office worker, I do have some exposure to some of the individuals that I work with. And the thing that surprises me is that I was a poster girl for adherence to all the restrictions. I mean, I was like compulsive about it. I was wearing 3 masks. I was washing my hands compulsively. And on top of that, I was actually restricting. I mean, my movements were extremely circumscribed. With exceptional work, I wasn't doing anything. And yet I ended up getting it. But I just have a question for Dr. Souther. There's a discrepancy in terms of the CDC guidelines post-COVID recovery and what the doctors are saying. The CDC says very specifically that when individuals are recovering, they should not get tested because there is a possibility that there might be some residual virus that is going to result in a positive test, even though the person does not have the capacity for transmission. When you talk to like an individual doctor, they say that you should get tested. I've been in isolation for 24 days now.
Wow.
I am petrified. I haven't come out of my room. I am experiencing a lot of anxiety. My symptoms have abated for the most part. But, you know, right now, the major impediment to my emergence from my room, which also obviously has psychological implications. You can well imagine the solitude, the isolation and everything. What does one do? Does one get tested? Because if there's residual virus, as the CDC is saying, and is saying don't get tested because you're going to get a positive test, but you're not going to be transmitting, could you please, I would appreciate any feedback, Dr. Souther.
And Zainab, have you continued to test positive toward your 24 days?
I have not been tested since then. I was tested initially when I had developed some vague symptoms.
Yeah, I see. Yes, because you're concerned about the result and the CDC guidelines. Yeah. So can you help her, Dr. El-Souther, briefly?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's recommended not after a positive test, not to get retested again for the subsequent 3 months, 90 days or so. And the reason is exactly what you said, is the test can be positive because it's picking up remnants of small pieces of the virus or dead virus, for example. And therefore, we don't recommend that people who've been diagnosed to be retested again for the 3 months duration after the diagnosis. So I think we need to disseminate this information widely so physicians are able to advise their patients of this information.
So if Zainab's symptoms have abated, as she said, does she need to keep isolating after 24 days, or can she go back into the world?
She can go back into the world. If symptoms have abated, I think you do not need to get retested, and you can go back into the world. But of course, remember, you, of course, have to practice all the protective measures that you did previously.
And you hear how she said she was so obsessive about practicing protective measures, but she had to come in close contact with some people in the course of her job, she said, so she assumed she got it from there. I guess that's an indication of, even being so careful, how much risk is out there.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we found that in the workplace, while people are careful during working hours in the distancing and the masking and so on, sometimes they let their guard down. I'm not saying that that's what you did, but they let their guard down during breaks or during lunch breaks, where they congregate in a break room, or and then, of course, that's when they have to pull their masks down, and again, in order to eat and drink and so on. So we are very much focused on the importance of consistency. And if you are going to be with someone in the same space, then please do observe the distancing. That's very vital, and try to keep the removal of the mask at minimum.
Teresa in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, good morning, Brian. I'm a longtime listener and a monthly sustainer. I have an elderly friend with severe pre-existing conditions. He never left the house. He had three family members taking care of him. He had to go into the hospital for a procedure unrelated to COVID, and he got COVID and is now in the hospital, and his three family members all tested negative. So they did not bring it in the house, so they believe he got it from the hospital procedure. Thank you so much. I'll listen the rest offline. Thank you.
Teresa, thank you very much. We have a few callers. I'm not going to go to the other ones because it would be a similar story, but a few who think they got it when they went out for routine medical procedures. Do you think that's happening, doctor?
Well, I certainly hope that it's not. I think there's, as you're well aware, there's screening, of course, of all healthcare workers daily. A symptom check to make sure that if anybody has a symptom, they're not allowed into the facility. There's also many health facilities are doing a frequent testing of their staff. And there's also a very much of an effort to make sure that people, again, are distancing and wearing masking, and also wearing face shields if they're providing additional face to the mask if they're providing patient care. So with all these measures, one would hope that there'd be minimum risk of transmission to an individual patient. But nonetheless, we know that we can minimize the transmission, but it's very hard to say that it can be zero risk. We can decrease the risk as much as we can through trying very hard to adhere to all these measures, but it's very hard to say that the risk can be zero risk.
And I imagine, Dr. El-Sadr, that with the scale-up of large-scale HIV public health programs that you've been involved with around the world, you've got some relevant experience for the scale-up of the vaccine distribution that's about to start in the United States and globally. And the vaccines are coming, and paradoxical as this may be, people are jockeying for position to be first in line and also saying, I'm not going first. So news stories this weekend said half of all New York City firefighters who would be early in line as first responders, half of them said in a survey that they won't take it. Back in August, only 30% of MTA workers said they commit to being vaccinated. We'll see how these numbers change when presented with a real vaccine in a COVID-soaked world rather than a survey. But some people are asking, why me? And other people are asking, why not me? And so, listeners, if you are first responders or frontline healthcare workers, this is the second call-in we're doing for Dr. El-Sadr. Are you ready to take the virus? Firefighters, call us. Police officers, call us. Doctors, nurses, EMTs, anybody who's going to be in that frontline professional A1 category for eligibility for the virus, are you going to take it? 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. Dr. El-Sadr, what do you think about these numbers? Do they indicate something real? And what's going to happen at your medical center?
Yes, I think they do indicate there's a substantial proportion of people, at least when they're theoretically asked the question if they will get the vaccine, they're quite hesitant about getting the vaccine. And I think we need to, and this may differ, like you said, as to, you know, when people are actually presented with the option of getting the vaccine. But nonetheless, I think it motivates us to think very carefully, and we are doing this now, in terms of how do we disseminate the correct information about these vaccines. So that's very important. Disseminating the information is critical. I think also very critical is engaging people from the communities, these prioritized communities, early on, so they have the information at their fingertips, and then we can also deal with some of the misconceptions that we know exist. And I think also very important, this is something that I've learned from my work locally and globally, is the value of engaging communities and identifying champions within those communities. They are the ones who can reach their peers. And that's really, really critically important that we do this work now to be able to get those champions who can disseminate the accurate information about the vaccine. And we have answers to a lot of the questions that people have. Some of the questions we don't have answers to, but at least we can engage in a conversation about the what we know now, and as well as what we don't know.
Maybe we have a few of those champions on the phones right now. Tanaz, a physician in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, doctor.
Hi, thank you so much for an amazing program. I'm going to take the vaccine 100%. I think the science is good. And as a physician, not just protecting myself, I have an opportunity to actually prevent the cycle from, like, me transferring to another person, which is very, very important, the vaccination. So I'll take it 100%.
That's really
excellent. And we know from other experiences that physicians and other healthcare workers are really valuable, because for many of us, you know, having a physician or your healthcare worker say, this is important, this is what you need to do, can be very motivating for people. So we certainly are also reaching out to physicians, because they are very important champions as well.
Here's a nurse, an RN, Sid in Greenpoint. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sid. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, Brian, a longtime listener. I'm very excited to get vaccinated. I personally am on my second isolation for COVID. I got tested. I have no symptoms, but because my patients were so asymptomatic, I felt it was important to get tested, and it was a real reality check, even for me, someone who eats lunch outside. I didn't even think it was as viral as it is, and I think it's we should all be really, you know, realistic about it. But I also understand some communities' reticence to take a vaccine, especially with the racist history of vaccinations in the United States and experiments. So it's a nuanced thing.
Did you say you're on your second isolation for COVID, meaning you think you've had it twice?
Well, I had a presumptive positive in the very beginning when testing was extremely limited back in March. So I can't say that for sure it was confirmed, but it was a better safe than sorry. And then now, right now, I'm on confirmed.
And where do you think you got it in the last month?
Well, it's interesting because my domestic partner is negative. I assume I got it at work, but I was wearing my N95. I follow all the donning doffing protocol. It's pretty confusing. I had two confirmed positive patients at work, so that's when I started testing regularly. And again, they were asymptomatic. They weren't being treated for COVID, but they were confirmed positive.
And then you turned up positive, and you are ready for the vaccine.
Oh, I am. Yes. I think it's important to vaccinate, especially as a frontline worker, and set a good example as a nurse.
Sid, thank you so much for your call, and I hope you feel well. Here's Uju, a dentist in South Orange. Uju, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. So as far as the vaccine, like I was telling the screener, I go back and forth. And for me, I believe in science. I definitely am not an anti-vaxxer. But I feel like there should be so much transparency where this is concerned. The only way for me I can trust anything is gone are the days of making decisions behind closed doors. So right now, you know, the FDA is looking at the information from Pfizer and Moderna. Once that's done on their end, they have to release every single piece of information. And I understand Pfizer and Moderna definitely want intellectual, you know, like property, whatever the terminology is, and they don't want anyone to copy them. But this is a one time in our lifetime that if you're going to get people on board, it has to be completely transparent. And I'm a endodontist, like, so my specialty is root canals. So I'm not going to sit here and expect me to know all the data, but I have a family friend who's an epidemiologist, and I told her, I said, once the data is transparent, I need you to look at it, and if you tell me this is legit and this is solid, then I will be the first one lining up to do it. But the thing is, it cannot be behind closed doors. This is so important, and this is, you know, too important to know that. And another thing is, and I know this is all evolving, and we don't know yet, but part of the data needs to be, if I take this, how long do I have, like, you know, for immunity? And legitimately, what are the side effects? Because I know when I took the tetanus vaccine, they told me, okay, which arm would you prefer it on, your right or your left? I'm a righty. They said, because you're going to have redness, you're going to have swelling in that area, it might hurt you for a few days. And lo and behold, 2 days later, I was like, oh, thank God I took it on my left arm because I'm a righty. Mm. So if I feel like, for me personally, if I have all the data and all the information, then, you know, we'll be fine. But on the contrast, my mom is a registered nurse, and she's constantly, you know, we always say we're African, you know, all the Africans' mom and aunts send all this spam via WhatsApp, and she's constantly sending all this stuff. And I'm like, come on, lady, you're a nurse. You're a healthcare worker. Mm-hmm. You should know better. I'm like, stop with the disinformation. And she's like, well, you got it in ticket and you died. I'm like, no, if the information out there is transparent and it's legit, it will be unwise to not do this, okay? Because at the end of the day, like, we have to have the information, and I feel like as human beings who are smart, we can make smart decisions, and the smart decision is if it's transparent and it works and we legitimately know the side effects and everything is out there, we will be out there taking it. That's just my two cents.
Uju, thank you so much. And yeah, and Dr. Alsada, we're going to run out of time soon. That was more than two cents, but such a beautiful explanation of some of the conflicts. I think a very clear description of some of the internal conflictedness that people have.
Yes, and I do agree, and I think transparency is very important. I think it's important for people to realize that even the information we have thus far are from independent safety monitoring groups that don't include the pharmaceutical company, and that's really critically important. And also that the FDA advisory group is quite a diverse group of individuals, includes ethicists and scientists, as well as also community members. And that the goal is, and the plan is, for the information that will be shared with the advisory group, that information will be shared with the public thereafter. I think that's very critical, because we need to be able to let people know exactly what the studies show, and also prepare them. If there are side effects, people can be prepared. As your caller indicated, if you know what to anticipate, I think it's much better than being surprised. So I feel like we have to really work very hard over the next couple of weeks to distill this information that's going to be coming out, and to take the information and disseminate it as widely as we can, and then be available to answer questions about the data.
All right. This is a start. So we've had two really interesting, I think, call-ins, a little informal, thoroughly unscientific epidemiology and vaccine resistance or willingness survey data with these two groups of callers who we've had on, and some great information from our guest, Dr. Wafa Alsada, epidemiology and global health professor at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University and director of their ICAP Center, which works on public health around the world. Dr. Alsada, thank you so much for the information today and for being so thoughtful with our callers. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.